Good afternoon, everybody. It's a very chipper crowd at lunch today. I guess lots to talk about with leadership change and everything else that's taking place this week. Thank you very much for joining us here at the FCC. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with Reuters and the Board of Governors here at the club. It's my pleasure to introduce Mr. Kuroda today. But before we get going, just a couple of quick housekeeping notes. Please remember to switch your mobile phones back on when you leave the club so we can have some silence during the next hour. And also, just to let you know of some of our upcoming events here at the FCC, the next event in this dining room will be an evening documentary showing next week. It's called The Revolutionary, and it's the story of Sidney Rittenberg, who actually you were debating whether he was the first American Communist Party member in China, but he did spend a lot of time in China with the Communist Party. He's now 91 years old, and the documentary is about him and his life in China. That's next week. Now, on to events of the day. Mr. Kuroda, here from Manila, is going to tell us how growth in Asia can be balanced, inclusive, and green. Sounds like quite a bit of challenge, but he does have the answers for us. Just to give you a bit of background on Mr. Kuroda, he was the Vice Finance Minister for International Affairs with the Japanese government. I think he served 30 years in Japan. And he's also been 10 years at the helm of the Asia Development Bank. His background is in law and economics. I did ask him what he does in his spare time with all that heavy work he's been doing. He said he did play golf for a while, but has stopped doing that. He did go scuba diving for a while in the Philippines, but he's gone off that as well. So now he spends his time reading and doing a little swimming at the weekends just to stay fit. So it's my pleasure to introduce Mr. Kuroda.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very pleased to be here with you today. I would like to thank the Foreign Correspondents Club for extending the invitation to speak to you about inclusive growth in Asia and the Pacific. In considering my remarks, I felt it important to expand the topic somewhat to also touch on a few other issues, namely the current economic outlook and the growth modality which is expected in the region. I call it inclusive, green, and knowledge-led growth. Let me begin with the economic outlook. As you know, Asia has enjoyed several consecutive decades of high growth. Following the recent upheavals in the global economy, Asia appears to have taken the reins and is now driving global growth. However, Asia is not immune to the ongoing effects of the slowdown in the United States and the ongoing sovereign debt crisis in the Eurozone. In fact, the global slump in demand for Asian exports has already placed a serious drag on the region's major economies. Our Asian Development Outlook Update, ADB's economic forecast, issued in October, lowered 2012 GDP growth forecast for China to 7.7% from the April projection of 8.5%. India has also had its growth forecast lowered. In India's case, the main issue are weak investment, low agricultural growth, ongoing fuel shortages, and infrastructure bottlenecks. While our April forecast indicated growth of 7% for fiscal year 2012, our October update is forecasting only 5.6% growth. Some of Asia's economies, especially ASEAN economies, remain resilient this year, but it is not certain whether immune to global sluggishness and the slowdown in the region's two largest emerging economies will last. Clearly, these factors affect the overall growth of the region. We now see developing Asia and the Pacific growing at 6.1% in 2012 and 6.7% in 2013, a significant drop from the 7.2% growth we saw in 2011. Fortunately, most economies in the region have ample room to use monetary and fiscal tools to smooth out these external and internal shocks. But in a heterogeneous region like Asia, policy responses must reflect the varying macroeconomic conditions of each individual country. Countries with sufficient fiscal space and low inflation rates should rely on expansionary policies if growth weakens significantly below projections. At rates that are above 6%, Asia's growth prospects are still relatively healthy. What regional authorities have to do is to fine-tune the slowdown, but use the weak external environment as an opportunity to undertake structural reforms to maintain developing Asia's growth momentum. Over the past two decades, the region earned the label Factory Asia because it sourced intermediate goods and parts from within Asia to assemble final goods for export to affluent markets. This propelled high growth in developing Asia and significantly reduced the number of people living in poverty. However, the protracted global slowdown has highlighted the fact that pursuing high growth through a heavy reliance on exports is no longer sustainable. With weakness in major industrial economies and decelerating growth in the region's two emerging giants, the future growth environment is less favorable. Economies in the region must therefore adapt by speeding up the rebalancing process, improving productivity, and enhancing efficiency. Rebalancing efforts should also be used as an opportunity to promote inclusive and environmentally sustainable growth. Rapid economic expansion in the last two decades lifted millions out of poverty, but this has been accompanied by rising inequality and serious environmental damage. Such a pattern of growth can no longer continue. By increasing expenditures in education, health, and social safety nets, governments can promote inclusive growth while fostering continued economic expansion. Developing a vibrant service sector in the region is an important way to supplant growth. The role of services is expected to expand as the region's economies undergo structural change. If developing Asia follows the same path traveled by advanced economies, agriculture's dominance will give away to industry, and the industry will then be supplanted by services. As manufacturing wages rise and its labor intensity falls, Asia will need to look more to services to create jobs for the millions who join the workforce every year. There is certainly room for the service sector to grow. The share of industry in developing Asia's output surpassed that of the OECD in 2010 at 41% versus 24%, but the share of services still lags by a wide margin. In developing Asia, the share of services is 48%, while in OECD countries, it is 75%. A more dynamic service sector is key to future growth. In developing Asia, the sector is still dominated by traditional services, such as restaurants and personal services like taxi drivers or barbers and so on and so forth. Modern services, such as internet connectivity technology and financial, legal, and other professional business services, occupy less than 10% of Asia's service economy. This is well below the 20 to 25% in advanced economies. A vibrant service sector could have broad economic benefits. Synergies between services and industry could improve overall productivity. For instance, industrial design, marketing, and legal services can facilitate investment and development of new manufactured products. The service sector also tends to be more effective in creating jobs, particularly for women, thus supporting inclusive growth. Developing the service sector can also diversify the production base, which will enhance the resilience of the economy and boost its growth momentum. But what is hindering service sector dynamism in Asia? Skill gaps and the lack of infrastructure are frequently cited, but burdensome regulations are the biggest barrier. Upgrading the service sector is low-hanging fruit for Asia because no tremendous investments are required. Yet excessive regulation persists. Regulations that protect incumbent firms and other vested interests keep Asian market less competitive and undermine productivity and efficiency. This leads me to my main topic, inclusive growth. There is no doubt that Asia's rapid growth has contributed to remarkable poverty reduction. However, growth has been uneven, favoring coastal areas over interiors, and cities over rural areas, and skilled labor and owners of capital over those with less skills and no capital. The result has been large and persistent pockets of income and non-income poverty and rising inequality, including in the fastest growing Asian economies. As of 2008, about 830 million people in developing Asia were still living below the $1.25 a day poverty line in terms of purchasing power parity. In 2010, 368 million Asian people still had no access to clean, reliable source of drinking water. Nearly 1.7 billion lacked access to proper sanitation. An estimated 83 million Asian children under 5 years of age are underweight, and each year about 3 million will die before reaching their fifth birthday. These chilling statistics set against the conspicuously growing wealth of many Asian countries illustrate what see as the two faces of Asia. Since the early 1990s, the Gini coefficient, a common measure of inequality, has risen in many Asian countries, including China, India, and Indonesia, Asia's most populous countries and drivers of the region's rapid growth. At the same time, global warming and climate change are significant global risks that will affect large numbers of Asian people, especially vulnerable people. Developing Asia already accounts for one-third of total global emissions. Mitigation and adaptation measures are urgently needed in the region. We have seen the center of economic gravity gradually shifting to Asia, and the challenges we face are huge. Asia's role in sustaining global growth is critical, and this will best be achieved by ensuring Asia's own strong growth continues. To do this, growth must be more inclusive, green, and knowledge-led. There are five core elements to this. First, more productive jobs are needed to keep growth resilient. Studies show an estimated 420 million Asians will enter the labor market by 2030. So creating decent employment opportunities remains a daunting challenge. Infrastructure development is essential to better logistics, stimulate the economy, and create jobs. Better infrastructure narrows the rural-urban divide and allow social programs like education and healthcare to reach the most vulnerable. Innovative approaches, including public-private partnerships, are critical to meet this massive investment challenge. Second, we must broaden human capital through new opportunities that help expand the middle class and rebalance sources of growth more toward domestic and regional demand as greater inclusiveness widens the consumer base. Third is providing effective social safety nets to mitigate risks and vulnerabilities caused by sickness, economic crisis, industrial restructuring, or natural disasters. Fourth is to finance investments that both mitigate and adapt to climate change. Asia is prone to extreme weather and catastrophic disasters. There are huge opportunities for profitable investments in green growth and disaster preparedness. And fifth is enhanced regional cooperation and integration. Broader openness within the region will increase economic resilience and promote sustained, more inclusive development. Freer trade and greater macroeconomic cooperation will enhance efficiency, strengthen stability, and sustain growth. 20 years after the start of the ADB-supported Greater Mekong Subregion program, we have seen a largely barren intra-regional road system become a lattice work of integrated transport corridors evolving into full-fledged economic corridors. We hope reforms underway in Myanmar will pave the way for further regional integration. ADB is fully behind these efforts. Of course, it goes without saying that good governance is critical to provide strong underpinning for inclusive growth. Poor governance, weak institutions, and systemic corruption pose significant risks to public sector service delivery and inclusive sustainable development. Countries across Asia and the Pacific are making concerted efforts to improve governance, but more must be done to promote inclusion, political stability, and investment. It is increasingly important that governments and institutions build their capacity to deliver inclusive growth, thereby ensuring that the benefits of growth are much more widely shared. In closing, I would like to reiterate that the continued weakness in the international economic environment provides a unique opportunity for developing Asia to undertake reforms for inclusive and sustainable growth. The challenge is great, but the potential for gains is undeniable. I firmly believe that Asia is ready to take on this challenge, and the benefits will be felt for generations to come. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kuroda. We have about 20 minutes for questions and answers. So if you'd like to raise your hand, give us your name and the organization you're with, if you're with one, and we'll come around to you. Who'd like to go first? Over here, Jane.
Jane Singer from Inside Fashion. we cover very extensively the apparel sector throughout the region. And of course, we see a lot shifting in terms of wage increases and countries in general wanting to move up the value chain. However, and what you're saying is very true about the need to develop a middle class and so forth. But realistically, given all, you know, the challenges that you've also noted, how quickly do you think this is likely to emerge? And I granted it will be different for different countries, but in general, what would you say in terms of emerging Asia getting closer to a par with what we consider to be the developed world?
I think this question has been asked and discussed quite intensively in the bank, as well as, of course, outside the bank. As you know, there used to be so many low-income countries, poor countries, but now many of them have become middle-income countries, like China or Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, so many low-income countries have successfully become middle-income countries through utilizing abundant labor force, and some, like Indonesia and so on and so forth, utilizing abundant natural resources as well. And we expect remaining low-income countries would be able to become middle-income countries in due course. As you may know, in Latin America, almost all countries are now middle-income countries. There are very few low-income countries, poorest countries left in Latin America. So we expect in the next couple of decades, most of low-income countries, for instance, like Pakistan, Bangladesh, or Cambodia, Myanmar, and so on, they will become middle-income countries, as I said, utilizing human resources, natural resources, opening up their economies, and so on and so forth. Now, the more difficult is to become high-income countries from middle-income countries. Actually, in Asia, even in the last 60 years of development effort, there are actually only four countries which could become high-income countries. There are four tigers: Korea, Hong Kong, Taiwan, or in ADB it's called Taipei China, and Singapore. Even Malaysia has not yet reached high-income country status. Thailand, middle-income country, and India, lower-middle-income country, and so on and so forth. So it must be really challenging to become high-income countries from middle-income countries. Because low wages, abundant labor, huge natural resources, and so on and so forth, may be able to raise low-income countries to middle-income countries. But in order to raise middle-income countries to high-income countries, there are need of stronger institutions, better governance, more innovative entrepreneurship, science and technology development. Quite a few challenges are faced by middle-income countries. So it's not easy, but I'm hopeful that in the next couple of decades, many middle-income countries could become high-income countries and eventually fully developed economies. But as I said, it's very challenging. And it's not just related to manufacturing sector or service sector or agriculture sector. It's the total economic and societal kind of development which can make
middle-income countries to high-income countries.
A question in right back here. Right there. We have a microphone for you. Did you have a question before? No. Change of plan. Anyone else over here?
Of course, any economy will have short-term, middle-term, and long-term challenges. I would focus on medium-term and long-term challenges faced by the Chinese economy. Medium-term, I think the Chinese economy must complete the so-called rebalancing. The Chinese economy used to be very much dependent on export as the engine of growth. And at one stage, export GDP ratio in China was 40% or something. Now it's around 30%. And current account surplus was about 10%. But now it's around 3%. So the Chinese economy has already made substantial progress in rebalancing the sources of growth from external demand to domestic demand. But if you look at the content of domestic demand, then you can find that it is mainly investment, industrial investment, infrastructure investment, and so on and so forth, rather than consumption. Now, I think this next stage of rebalancing is to focus more on consumption. Investment in China is huge, and the investment GDP ratio is really amazingly high. But I think now the challenge in the medium run to complete the rebalancing process is to encourage consumption. How to do it? Of course, household income must be increased, and also household propensity to consume must be increased. In order to do so, of course, social safety net must be strengthened, education, healthcare, also provision must also be strengthened also. Now, in the long run, as I said, I expect the Chinese economy from middle-income status to high-income status at some stage. So in the long run, Chinese economy must become more innovation-oriented. I mean, not so much dependent on foreign technology, foreign capital, but domestic technology, domestic innovation, and so on and so forth. Because after all, if the Chinese economy continue to catch up to OECD economies, then the room for catching up is to shrink. So in order to continue high growth, China must originates its own innovation, technology, product, marketing, or whatever. And it requires, as I said, quite a few structural transformation. But as I said, I'm sure that I expect that, that China would eventually become a high-income country.
I have a quick question, and then I'll pass it on. It was interesting to hear you speak about middle income moving to high income. You mentioned countries such as Korea, China, and Hong Kong. When you move to the talk about green, maybe our incomes are going up in Hong Kong, maybe we're headed towards being a high income country, but our air is terrible. What is the gap that countries that are moving up the income level in Asia just don't get their head around sustainability and creating a greener environment? Is it cultural or?
I don't think so. I think it's, I mean, if you look at the economic history of Europe, US and Japan, then you can find that yes, those countries had also experienced a stage of rapid economic development and concomitantly rapid degradation of the environment, air pollution, water pollution, so many environmental degradation that they experienced. But then at some stage they changed the course and they invested invested in environment, improved the environment with huge efforts. Now, in some sense, developing countries in Asia can have a good opportunity to sort of leapfrog rather than waiting until the environment is severely damaged. I mean, pursuing rapid growth, but at the same time, the green growth, environmentally sustainable growth, and that I think is possible if you look at Japan or European countries now. They are very energy efficient, and the environment is heavily protected, and of course. They had already achieved a very high income status. But I think there are a few things to be done in Asia. One is, of course, appropriate environmental regulation. And but regulation itself necessary but not sufficient. And then the various measures to support environment be protected. For instance, just one example is renewable energy development. ADB now is investing hugely in renewable energy, like solar power, wind power, geothermal, and waste to energy projects in Asia. Recently, ADB financed the three solar power projects in Thailand. All of them are private sector projects. Why it was possible? Because the Thai government introduced a feeder tariff system which provide not permanent but temporary cross subsidy to power generated by renewable energies, so that private companies can build and operate solar power plants, and ADB provided part of necessary finance and, of course, technical advice. So, I mean, on the one hand, appropriate technology and financing, but also appropriate policies of the government, not just regulation, but policy to solicit, encourage energy efficient development, and so on and so forth.
We had a question over here.
concept of really a cursor role term that leads is Asia. You mentioned in your talk about how important governance is, and it seems that there's a governance deficit here, certainly a number of what you might call it green projects. I'm thinking particularly of the hydropower projects on the Mekong River. Recently, a Swedish firm was involved in doing environmental impact assessments. It's been investigated by the Finnish government for essentially cooking the books and allowing the Lao government to push ahead with the Sayuri projects. What specifically is the ADB doing to respond to that situation?
I think hydropower is or will continue to be a very important source of energy, clean energy, renewable energy by itself. But at the same time, in Asia there are so many international rivers. Rivers are important for providing drinking water, irrigation water, industrial water, and so on and so forth. And any hydropower project should not undermine those other competing need of utilizing river basin. And the environment must be carefully, environmental impact must be carefully assessed. In the Greater Mekong sub-region, in the last 15 years or so, ADB has been sponsoring so-called GMS, the Greater Mekong Sub-Regional Program to improve transport, energy, water, and telecommunication infrastructure in the region. And we have been very careful when we support hydropower projects. And the Greater Mekong is so important. So there is a Mekong River Commission to monitor and control the use of water in the region. Separately, as I said, the GMS program, ADB has been sponsoring, and the environmentally sustainable development in transport, energy, and water is possible and has been pursued. And I, at this stage, by the way, ADB does not support major hydropower projects on the main trunk, or main part of the Mekong River, because it might affect seriously the downstream countries in the future.
We have time for one quick last question over here in the back.
Mr. Kuroda, this is Stephanie from Bloomberg News. I have a question on like the fourth quarter economic outlook. So because we already see Singapore growth declines in the third quarter, and we're expecting growth in like Malaysia, Philippines, and also like Thailand will also be falling in the third quarter. Can we say the economy is kind of like bottom out, and we're expecting some recovery in the fourth quarter? What's your outlook? Thank you.
Yes, actually, we expect the economy most economies in Asia bottom out sometime this year, and we expect slight acceleration of growth in most of economies in the region. And the recent statistics came from China show some improvement compared with just a couple of months ago, and also Indonesia. As I said, ASEAN countries are doing very well. Indonesia, the Philippines, they are showing quite robust growth, and we will expect those economies to accelerate next year. So, on the whole, Asian countries are likely to increase growth next year. But compared with a few years ago, particularly compared with 2009 and 10, and even compared with 2011, the growth rate in 2013, next year, still not so high. So external environment, as I said, Europe, US, and Japan may continue to grow on a sort of suboptimal level. So external environment continue to be not so good. In this situation, as I said, developing countries in Asia, emerging economies in Asia must focus more on domestic demand and regional demand. And that is possible, and actually many governments are taking necessary measures to do so. So we expect gradual recovery of growth next year, and as well as yeah, after the next.
And it's 2 o'clock. We'll leave it on that slightly optimistic note. Mr. Kuroda, thanks very much for being with us and for being our guest at the FCC, a small gift as well today. Have a lovely afternoon, everybody.